This is Shambhala Sun, editor of web publications Rod Mead Sperry, and you're listening to Shambhala Sun Audio. Green Dharma, environmental compassion, just common sense, whatever you call it, there's never been a better time to bring Buddhist principles into our attempts to better care for our planet. That's one of the themes of our new issue, and so I recently spoke to teacher and author Ethan Nichtern of New York City's The Interdependence Project. Environmentally and socially active, the ID Project exemplifies how groups and individuals can truly make a difference when it comes to making the world a better place. In this Shambhala Sun audio interview, Ethan explains just what that means. Now, we've certainly spoken many times in the past, but the reason that I wanted to speak to you today is because we're talking in our new issue about green dharma, as it were. And I wanted to speak to you because you do two things that are interesting and important for people to hear about. First of all, I know that you have your own practices that you do and that you've taught other people to do, for example, myself. But also, I think that the Interdependence Project as a model really shows the kind of positive environmental impact that a great organized group of people can have. So I wanted you to start by talking about what the IDP has done.
Yeah, the sort of heart of what the IDP is a ecumenical Buddhist-inspired, a place for people to practice meditation and study Buddhism. But what grows out of that, and what I think is very much part of the path, is we have a lot of arts projects, and then we have a whole integral activism program that we work with a New York State senator who's a meditator on. And one of the main initiatives we work on is an eco-activism initiative that both has a questioning of and mindfulness of individual consumption patterns as part of the sort of practice, and also has a political advocacy. And the issue we've been working on, which is surprisingly difficult to actually enact any kind of political change, is eventually eliminating plastic bags in New York State and beyond.
How does that manifest as something actionable that you can work on? What does that mean, trying to make that change?
Yeah. If you break the Eightfold Path down into its three sort of sections, what are sometimes called the three trainings of view, or your philosophical study, your meditation practice, and your conduct, your ethical actions, which is really the main bulk of the path, let's be honest, because nobody's going to be in the modern world meditating the majority of time. They're going to be in the world the majority of the time. I think the more and more I study, the more respect I have for how complete the teachings on meditation that are offered in the tradition really are. And the philosophical views are in terms of what reality is, sort of are pan-cultural and don't really have to do with time or place. But I do think it's the teaching how we conduct ourselves ethically and compassionately in the world, in the interdependent contemporary culture that we live in, that needs some real updating. And I think the main difference when you look at the time of the Buddha versus now is we have this completely globalized capitalist democratic society. And, you know, there's really no Buddhist teachings up until very recently about how to bring one's Buddhist practice into a democratic worldview, because democracy is a very new evolution in human society. And also, I think capitalism is a fairly new evolution. And the idea of individuals viewing themselves as consumers has a lot of detriments, and I think the Dharma can really speak to that. So the first part of, I think, green Dharma, or being more environmentally mindful and compassionate, is noticing that we do exist in this society that asks us to view ourselves as consumers, and bringing mindfulness and the view of interdependence to that and becoming more responsible consumers. Sometimes people say that they don't think Buddhism should be political in some ways, but I think once you actually start questioning the nature of desire, the nature of attachment, you have to get into how those things actually play out in our society. And the next thing we're going to have to question is consumption and its link to planet Earth and ecology. So, I mean, I think the first part of what we do at the ID Project, we have these month-long responsible consumption practices where people really try to bring practice of mindfulness to questioning what they consume and how they participate in planet Earth. And we ask people to maybe focus on one area. Like the first time we did it, I was a vegetarian at the time, and I tried to be vegan for the month to work with that as a mindfulness practice.
How'd that go?
It went well. I didn't stick with it, mainly because I like cheese too much, and soy cheese is just really bad. So if anybody listening to this can give me some advice on where to find good vegan cheese, I'd be really grateful.
I think we all could use that advice.
Yeah, we all could use that advice. And then some people, it's giving up plastic bags. I mean, I think some people who are listening to this probably already don't use plastic bags. I know when we've done political canvassing on the streets of New York, there's a lot of Europeans in New York now, and they can't believe that we still use plastic bags. So that would be an interesting practice as a mindfulness practice, as a post-meditation practice in one's life. Can I make it through this entire month without using a single plastic bag? It's actually not that hard if you just shift your attitude to be mindful about it. And then the added component beyond just responsible individual consumption is beginning to notice the way our collective actions and our collective mindsets actually create the reality and create the culture and create the society that we live in, and that we actually do have agency that our Buddhist ancestors didn't, who lived in monarchical or agrarian tribal societies, didn't really have, in that we can get together as a collective and say, I would like, my vote would be that plastic bags should have a fee on them, for example, or we need to change agricultural policy to make it much easier to grow organic produce, or we need to give tax incentives in cities to farmers markets rather than large conglomerate chain grocery stores or things like that. There's so many things. Once you get into looking at things mindfully, you see that in democratic society, there's so many structural decisions that are made by people who are elected that we are in some way participating in wittingly or unwittingly. So I really think the view of interdependence and mindfulness really problematizes the idea that it's possible to not participate in politics. This is one point I'd like to make very strongly. Sometimes I ask people, what is the biggest political party in the United States, for example?
Yeah.
Probably now somebody would say Democrats, right? Because Obama won the last election and won it fairly handily. But up until then, you could say we were 50-50 Democrats, Republicans. Well, that's actually up in 2000, 2004. That's 50-50 of the 50% of able people who actually voted.
Exactly.
So the other 50%, it's really 50% apathy party, 25% Democrats, 25% Republicans.
It's easy to get behind the apathy party.
It is, and it's also easy, I think, for us as meditators to understand why that notion of withdrawal from the world that's really caused us a lot of pain makes sense as a first step. We're not going to go forth into the wilderness as yogis and ascetics and eventually monastics. But if you frame your meditation practice as that little break from your life, that period of seclusion, that sort of going forth into your sangha or going forth into your bedroom to be with your mind, then it makes sense why this notion of withdrawal, there's a tendency towards viewing that as the right thing to do as Dharma practitioners. Or there's a tendency to think, you know, the other thing about American society is that we have this binary political system, which plays very much into the Buddhist critiques of duality, you know, and why we need to look past duality. I mean, I think if we even had three parties, more Buddhists would get involved because then you wouldn't have this obvious us versus them of Democrats versus Republicans. But I do think the idea that we can actually participate and that we do need to update the Buddhist teachings on right action, right speech, and right livelihood to include political participation is really kind of pressing. So we're working with a couple contacts we have in the New York State Senate, which at this point has actually become a bit of a joke because it shut down basically due to corruption. The corruption happened because of former non-participation. It's because people were not paying attention and a small number of really corrupt politicians, including this one gentleman from the Bronx, got into power when nobody was really voting and could hijack the whole system. So if we take that kind of message and say, see, democracy's broken, politics don't work, what's the point? It was actually that attitude that created that system. So the answer is actually to engage more. And so we're trying to get a law on a fee on plastic bags passed as one simple political act that we can take and organize our community and organize other communities around that. When you get involved in politics, you realize that to engage is really to change people's perception. That's what you have to do. You have to figure out how people are habitually perceiving themselves in relationship to a particular issue or a particular object or field of experience, and you have to see where a shift is possible. You know, that's the other thing, is it's like those people I see who I get to watch sort of as a Dharma practitioner who are very involved in political activity, basically what they're trying to do on a large scale in terms of noticing and shifting perception to a more open or a different way of looking at things is the exact same thing we try to do on an individual level as meditators. So it makes complete sense that the two fields would intersect with each other. Mm-hmm. Obviously, somebody could say, why plastic bags? It's just one area of responsible consumption or being eco-friendly, but it's a particularly egregious area. And just like in meditation, it's good to have an object of meditation, such as the breath, that opens our awareness by gathering our mind to it. We can actually open our awareness to our mind and the world beyond the breath. It's good to kind of have a focal point for an activity such as this, because if you say something like, oh, let's just be eco-friendly, anybody who's tried to investigate what that means in interdependent reality finds out very quickly that it means millions and millions of tiny choices. So just focusing in on one or two of those choices and kind of really going deeper with them is a good way to, I think, do the practice of what you're talking about in terms of green dharma.
And the plastic bag thing, I've seen it work in Europe. And what happens is people are initially, of course, resistant to that change. But when they go to the store enough times and they know that they're going to be charged 50 cents for a plastic bag, they bring their own bags. It works.
Yeah, it totally works. There are certain cities in the U.S., Seattle passed, a 20-cent fee on plastic bags that then the plastics industry actually pushed back quite hard with quite a lot of money against that going into effect. Portland for a while was looking at enacting a fee. San Francisco has a ban, but I don't know actually how effective that has turned out to be. So a lot of cities are definitely doing like things like that. And it is a shift in consciousness. I mean, I remember I spent a lot of time in the East Village, and when Whole Foods opened in the East Village and they stopped using plastic bags because they had such a huge market share of the East Village, it definitely did change patterns. Patterns can change very quickly, especially when a lot of people are doing something. That's the really interesting thing, is culture can change actually quite rapidly. And we are social beings. I think that's the other thing that we as Dharma practitioners could remember, is that we're not just doing our own practice to affect our mind. We are really shifting the way our mind works, and that automatically has a radiance to other people. We do always affect other people. It is very possible to affect people with positive pressure. I do think psychologically, Americans, we view ourselves as consumers. We are caught up in that habitual pattern more than any country that's ever existed. I think there is sort of a more collective impulse kind of ingrained into some European cultures and some Asian and African and Latin American cultures, that there's never been quite the consumeristic animal as the United States. I mean, you know, supposedly the great teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, when asked what the hungry ghost realm looked like, have you heard what he said?
I have not. I have a guess, but
I heard he just said America.
That would have been my guess. Wow.
Yeah, but it can shift quickly.
Well, that's true. And then one way or the other, whether dealing with the environment or other things, this is very much what the IDP is about.
Yeah, our basic thing is about, you know, a 21st century take on Buddhism. And I'm a teacher in the Shambhala tradition, and my main teacher is a really amazing teacher who probably most people know, Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche.
Yeah, he probably would be familiar to most frequent readers of The Sun because he's a columnist. Yeah.
Yes. So what we're really about is Buddhism, but I think really one of the things we're looking at is how to make Buddhism really accessible. And I think one of the ways to make it accessible is to sort of not wait for the world to come to it, but to actually create activities that engage in what I like to call, you know, applied dharma, like the Integral Activism Program that we're working on with Senator Schneiderman, like our arts programs, like our blog, which is on BeliefNet, and podcast. You know, so really trying to create a whole culture of people who are interested in Buddhism and are exploring it, but are really exploring it in connection to the lives that they're already living. You know, without a ton of you have to do things this way, without the pressure of lineage, and meaning that it's more based on the exploratory aspects of the present moment than trying to uphold a sense of what was done in the past. And, you know, we do have three lineage mentors of sort of three of the main Buddhist practice lineages that one can work with in the U.S. and in the Western world. One is Acharya Spiegel, Eric Spiegel, the great teacher in the Shambhala tradition. One is Sharon Salzberg, great insight teacher and probably familiar to most folks. And Roshi Enkyo Ohara, who's the head teacher at the Village Zendo in New York and a really wonderful Soto Zen teacher. So we have a strong sense of trying to identify with established Buddhist lineages and really studying Buddhism seriously. That's another thing I'm finding as a Buddhist teacher is if you ask people to step up and practice, you know, they want the real deal. And they want the real deal in a way that's accessible to their life. For me, there is a sense that the teachings on meditation and the psychological teachings of just how the human mind work, I do think we have to view those more and more from a Western psychological perspective. We're doing a series right now at the ID Project with two psychologists and Buddhist teachers on looking at the intersections of various cognitive therapies and Buddhist thought. I mean, when the Buddha gave the Satipatthana Sutta and taught the four foundations of mindfulness, that is a path to enlightenment. And from a certain point of view, you don't have to do more than that. But I do think we have to look at the ethical implications of Buddhism and the sort of culture of Buddhism very, very differently than was looked at in the ancient world. It might take a little while longer for that to happen. When I think about my teacher, Sakyan Nyingpa Rinpoche, he has to hold so much of two cultures. You know, people sometimes don't realize this about him because they're so familiar with his father, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, but really in terms of Tibetan history, who Meepam Rinpoche is considered to be an incarnation of, Meepam the Great, his sort of role in Tibetan culture is very deep. He has to hold monasteries in India and Tibet when he goes back there, and so he has to pay a certain level of homage, not just to the Tibetan Buddhist teachings, but to the Tibetan Buddhist culture. And he has to be this really wide bridge between two cultures. He has to pay a tremendous amount of respect to understanding 21st century Western culture. For me personally, he does both of those things just completely amazingly. But I think it might be another generation, and it might be specifically those of us who studied, whose primary teachers are Westerners, who don't feel that sense of cultural otherness because we're not trying to preserve a culture, and we also, our direct teacher wasn't trying to preserve another culture, so our teachers were Westerners. So I think it might be another generation before we have the full sense or the beginning of the full sense of kind of Western Buddhist ethics. And I do think that unless industrialized society and democracy collapse and we all start running around like Mad Max, I do think that's going to have to include a democratic ethics system for how to participate in interdependent democratic society as a Dharma practitioner. For that reason, I think the teachings on right conduct are going to have to include how we work in the interdependent sphere of politics. That's the way Senator Schneiderman defines politics. Sometimes he says people focus way too much on electoral politics. Politics is how people come together collectively as groups and make decisions about the shared sphere of reality that affect everybody. The Buddhist ethics doesn't quite, it's very individualized historically in terms of what to do and what not to do. It doesn't have that sort of collective action feel to it, and I do think that's going to have to be updated.
Well, so based on Schneiderman's definition of politics, then that very much makes sense that the IDP would be getting involved with the things it's getting involved in.
Yeah. And, you know, we're also starting a prison project. One of our community members works with a great organization in New York called the College Initiative, which basically places formerly incarcerated people in college courses, mostly in the city university system. And we're first setting up a service project so that IDP members are tutors to the formerly incarcerated people who are entering college courses. I think that's going to be a great program. But I think a lot of Dharma communities that are involved in prison work, for example, that service aspect would be the sort of extent of where we feel comfortable as a Dharma community engaging. And we're hoping to take it a step further, looking into prison policy and political advocacy on prison issues. It's such a huge issue. It's the U.S. incarcerates people at 5 to 8 times the rate of any other Western wealthier nation. I mean, that's just utterly insane. And that's political. That's the legal system. That's how we get together and elect people who then pass laws that say, let's send lots more people to jail. If you just viewed it as a service act, part of activism is completely serving and being a bodhisattva and volunteering for the benefit of others. But if you just viewed prison policy as a service act, you would never scratch the surface of the political problem of the legal structure that causes us to send people to jail at a much higher rate than anywhere else in the so-called civilized world. That also needs to be viewed as a political issue, if we're really going to look at it mindfully and interdependently.
Absolutely. And in terms of sustainability, makes a lot of people a lot of money, right, but it's not sustainable in the long run. Now, getting back just quickly to this discussion of ecology, you know, when people talk about Buddhism and the ecology, often we use phrases like environmental awareness, environmental mindfulness. You used a phrase a little while ago when we were first talking about this. You said environmental compassion. Is that a phrase that you have used before?
Probably was just rambling. You like it?
I think that it is really the kind of term that I'd like to see people embrace. There's a compassion that we don't think of sometimes, and that's really what you're talking about here, is heeding the cries of the world, so to speak, in a very literal way, and responding to them in a very literal way.
Yeah, I think the greatest strength and greatest weakness of the Dharma is speaking generically. We speak generic or generally about things like suffering and compassion and desire because we want to actually reach many different people, you know. So there's something great about speaking generally, and we don't know what specific instances of suffering are going to look like. But when you say any of those words, environmental awareness or environmental compassion, unless you translate that into a very specific object of mindfulness, a call to action, a something to focus on, the Dharma can be left in this sort of vague ethical realm where anything goes. You know, from the point of view of planet Earth, anything does not go. I'll go right out and say, if you want to be compassionate to the environment, use less disposable stuff. So that's a little bit more specific. It's still vague. So we should look with our tools of mindfulness, look around our house and say, what am I doing that I could do more efficiently? If I haven't looked into a CSA, community supported agriculture, which are great, by the way, in New York, they're really taking off. Let me look that up online right now. You know, so it's not just like this mushy, open heart. The heart of loving kindness is wonderful. It's the absolute reality, but it has to direct itself at very specific choices on planet Earth. So I think maybe the notion of environmental compassion, if we want to define it right now, could be specifying our mindfulness, not letting ourselves slip into our dharmic vagaries, which I know I slip into all the time. Being like, what can I actually change? Okay, look around the room right now. Am I using plastic bottles? Let me go out and get a stainless steel bottle right now. Can I bike more? Is there a way to make energy in my household more efficient? Take mass transit more? Those are Dharma practices. Those are post-meditation practices. Just saying like, oh, green, green, green. I mean, you're familiar with the term greenwashing.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that companies and advertisers can just say things are green without giving any of the details. And I think as Dharma practitioners, we could be greenwashing our mind unless we say, here are the specific, you know, three things I'm gonna work on today. And make it simple, like the breath. Don't expect yourself to change like 20 things in one day. Just work with one thing for a week and get in a better habit with that and then move on to the next thing. And it's really fun. Eating at farmers markets, you eat much better, you know. It doesn't have to be drudgery. It doesn't have to be guilt, but it does have to be specific. So I'd be really interested to hear, you know, what other people are doing kind of specifically as Dharma practices to change the way they're using energy and creating footprints on the planet.
We'll be having some discussion about exactly that on Sunspace, so I hope that you'll feel comfortable to come and weigh in. And, you know, what you're talking about is important, and that's exactly why I'm talking to you now. I'm sure you've inspired a couple of people, so thank you very much, Ethan.
Thanks, Rod. Great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. That was Ethan Nichtern talking about green dharma and social engagement as Buddhist practice. For more on Buddhism and the environment, see our September 2009 issue, On Stands Now. You'll also find more on ChambalaSun.com and ChambalaSunspace. This is Rod Mead Sperry, and thanks for listening to Shambhala Sun Audio.